Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 54 and it is the 6th of April. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking, well, we're going to be playing the audio of Dr. Bella DeBerra, great friend of the podcast's chat with Professor Robert Toombs. Obviously, a lot of our listeners might have been at the events we had with him. He was if you guys don't know, he's a Cambridge professor, became quite the international celebrity for being an academic in favour of Brexit. And he recently toured Australia with the IPA, and I think him and Bella are just talking all sorts of stuff. So we're going to be playing that interview over the next 3 episodes.
Wrote a great book.
He did write a great book, The English and Their History.
Speaking Peoples. Yeah, I'm reading it now, but I can't remember the title.
Right, okay.
But it's on the...
Yeah, you're absolutely devoured in
it. Google it.
Yeah.
How did Bella get that interview? She really muscled in on our turf there.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think it was like we were going to book in Bella for a video of the her conversation with Professor Robert Toombs, and then also he'd come on this podcast. But I mean, I had a look at the guy's schedule. That was a crazy week for him, so we couldn't swing it.
Typical Bella.
Maybe Bella was just like inundating him with stuff to do over here so that she got the scoop.
But loves the limelight.
Yeah, tricks on her because it's still our podcast. So we're going to be playing the 3-part over the next few episodes, sort of how we did with Dennis Prager. So it's just going to be on little different topics. So hopefully you guys enjoy those. And we're also going to be talking to IPA Research Fellow Morgan Baird, great friend of the podcast. He's had a huge week. He's released a report into religious liberty in Australia. He's had an article in The Australian on farms in Queensland. And he's also got a few takes on a few other issues as well.
Oh, he's going off.
Yeah. He interviewed himself. Pete and I were just along for the ride.
In the future.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Cool. So let us get into some of the stories that have happened this week. But I guess we should probably talk. Last 2 episodes, we've had a whole heap of great feedback about the Dennis Prager stuff. Really fun chat. Thank you again to Dennis Prager and the United Israel Appeal for giving us the time. So if you guys want, we've got a fair few things for you guys. If you enjoyed the interview, or if you haven't heard it before, obviously it's the last 2 episodes of the show. So if you are listening on iTunes or SoundCloud or our website, you can just, you know, figure out the last 2 episodes, 53 and 52. You can listen to part 1 and part 2. If not, we've got the whole podcast on our website, the whole interview just in one block.
Special edition.
Special edition of the podcast. I recorded an intro by myself.
It's a limited edition.
Yes.
For everyone who has the internet.
Yeah. There's poor 5 people that can't listen to it. We also have the video. If you're braver than Pete and I and are able to watch 54 minutes of Pete and I on video, then that's also available of us talking to Prager. And there's also a transcript on the website. So if you guys want to share that around, maybe get some other people who might be interested in what Dennis had to say, that's all on our website.
Yeah, well, I watched 10 seconds of that video and I went, oh, no, I hate watching myself.
Yeah, I'm like, why is your hair like that? You look like a mad scientist.
Yeah, plus I was there, so I know what happens.
Yeah, the ending was ruined. Cool. Do you have any other reflections on Dennis Prager?
Oh,
tall dude.
What a bloke.
I think we already discussed
very
that
tall.
Part, but very tall.
Very tall. What a bloke. Walked in. So this guy's world famous. Walked in and goes, you know, I'll be the easiest person you'll ever have to work with.
Yeah.
And he was. He said it was a bit warm, but that's all right.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I want to be the easiest person you've ever worked with, but can you change the temperature?
Yeah, It wasn't like a brown M&M's issue.
Yeah, exactly. And he did walk out of the room the second we said, "I don't think we have a thermostat in here."
So no, he was great, and I loved his line about, you know, identity politics being racist. Not like, don't you think this is informed by the same logic as?
Yeah, no, it's racist.
It's just racist. Yeah. So I loved that, and that's what I've been going with since then.
Yep, and I also liked how he had just woken up and was already like he'd woken up what like 20 minutes before and was just so on point.
Yeah.
Like, didn't need a warm up. Was just bang, bang, bang. Truth bombs left, right, and center. And
truth bombs.
Yeah, they were. They were. And also getting up at 3 a.m. to do his radio show in the US.
Like, what a bloke.
This guy is a pro.
Yeah.
Absolute professional. Cool. So, yeah, hopefully you guys enjoyed those interviews. If you did, leave us that 5-star review on iTunes. Let us know what you thought about it. Cool. So let's go into the stories of the week. So probably the big story out of Canberra this week is this the Monash Group or the Monash Forum. I've heard them referred to as 2 different things. I'm pretty sure it's Monash Group. Backbench Liberal MPs led by Tony Abbott, Kevin Andrews and Erica Betts, they are calling for the government to So they're calling for government-funded coal-fired power stations. Like, they want those.
Yeah.
They want them bad.
Yeah.
Which is... So John Roskin, our esteemed... Like, our glorious leader here at the IPA...
he makes us call him that.
As we pray to his statue in the lobby. Yeah. So he wrote a brilliant article today. You can read it on our website where it's just like, you know, the IPA, Pete and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we're not overly over the moon about the concept of a government-owned coal-fired power station.
No.
Don't really like the government being involved in energy at all.
That doesn't sound good.
But as John says, it's worth supporting just because energy policy is so broken in Australia that anything would work as long as we get somewhere that, as long as we're thinking about affordability, we're finally getting somewhere.
Well, look, I don't. I think he was kind of like, "Who are you to call this scheme socialist?" Which it obviously is, given how socialist.
Yeah, sorry.
Everything in Australia is. He had a couple of quotes. Listen to this: the National Energy Guarantee has the same market relationship. Sorry, I stuffed that up. National Energy Guarantee has the same relationship to the concept of the market as Politburo elections in the Soviet Union had to democracy. Whack. Wow. The next one. Sorry, I'm sorry to. Keep going. No doubt the commissars of energy of Australia will create a market system every bit as successful and enduring as that invented by the commissars of socialism in Moscow in 1960 as they decided on the market for brown shoes in Novosibirsk. Our fearless leader. Wowee. What a Friday.
Yeah, so that's on our website. Yeah, I did like this. So Turnbull's asked... So it's basically this like rebel backbench MPs who are like, we need coal-fired power stations, the government should run it. And obviously this is at odds with senior leadership who are sort of, you know, sort of stepping a bit away from coal, trying to get into renewable energy. So Malcolm Turnbull, interviewed by Brisbane ABC Radio, is asked about it. And he says, our future is one that includes all technologies, coal, wind, solar, gas, hydro. They are neither good nor bad. And it's like, this isn't a good, bad issue. This is it's an affordability issue.
Yeah.
And none of the stuff you guys are pushing is affordable.
Well, if they're neither good nor bad, let's just let them compete against each other.
Yeah. Well, yeah, leave it to the market to decide. Yeah. What a novel idea, Pete. Cool. So, yeah, check out that article if you guys are interested in it. So we'll also talk universal basic income.
Yes. So Matthew Lesh wrote a great piece earlier this week in The Age, I believe. Nina's nodding.
Yep.
Yep. About a scheme proposed by Richard Di Natale of the Greens, leader at the National Press Club during the week, about a universal basic income, which is an unconditional payment made to all citizens, no matter how rich or poor they are. So, oh my God, imagine the concept of middle-class welfare like that doesn't happen. The thing that Matthew pointed out in his piece was that this wouldn't replace, you know, health services and education services, as it's currently often talked about in the abstract by proponents of UBI, as it's called for short, yep. don't actually be on top of that. So he said, and I will...
So it's just, it's going to get even less affordable.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it was already unaffordable to begin with.
Yeah.
Now it's going to get real unaffordable.
Well, young Matthew says that it will require a 60% marginal income tax for median earners and an 80% for high earners. Would it cost an additional $230 billion a year? So obviously this is... bonkers.
Yeah.
But, and also would mean a lot of people don't work, even more so than now, would miss out on the dignity of work. He took a bit of a swipe at the Greens, saying that given that most of the Greens supporters are knowledge workers, it's unsurprising that they would be condescending to the working class.
Yeah.
Wow, hey.
Yeah.
We've been eating angry pills this week, the IPA.
We need a good weekend. Yeah, so what I don't get about the like universal basic income is that no one ever sort of says, oh, you also get extra if you're, you know, disabled or if you're mentally incapacitated. And it's like, but they don't? aren't they the most who need help?
Well, I mean, it's like it just completely turns the concept of welfare on its head, which is welfare is for the destitute.
Yeah, and it's like, no, everyone gets welfare.
Welfare is for everyone.
Yeah, and as Lesh points out, it's like, you know, the problem with safety nets is people get tangled up in them, which I really like this phrase. Cool. The other thing that the Greens proposed, so Richard Di Natale's speech to the press club where he's like, oh, we need a UBI. He also wanted a people's bank. Which is, you know,
I've heard this
we've never tried that before. Like, no one's ever tried a people's bank.
What
would it be like? So the Greens want a people's bank to give Australians low-cost mortgages and cheaper banking. In the quote here from Di Natale, in the face of ongoing misconduct and price gouging, it's time for government to step in and ensure that there is a low-cost banking service backed directly by the RBA, which is focused on everyday savings and mortgage needs of customers. What do you think about a bank that's focused on customers?
Yeah, well,
I like it as a concept.
Yeah,
bank focused on customers.
I'm interested.
Yeah,
I'm interested.
Don't love the government, the back directly by the RBA thing.
Well, to take a page out of John Roskam's playbook, like the financial sector is completely socialist anyway. So who cares if a government runs a bank?
Yeah, that's true. Cool. And it's also like, oh, we need to break up the big four by having a fifth. And yeah, that's just going to create a big five. But anyway.
But the reason there's a big four is because of regulation.
Yeah, exactly.
There could be heaps more.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Could be seven.
Yeah, so let's just pitch. Could be any number.
Yeah.
We should pitch deregulation to Di Natale, see what happens. Cool. So another thing, we're running a bit long here, so we'll try and keep this going. So another thing that's come out this week is the report by the Australian Law Reform Commission into Indigenous incarceration. The report is called Pathways to Justice. And so it's sort of just looking at the problem that we have in this country. Indigenous incarceration is obviously quite high. Stat here, Indigenous Australians are incarcerated at 12.5 times the rate of non-Indigenous. So it's obviously a huge problem.
Mm.
And it's really cool that we're talking about it because, you know, usually when Indigenous Affairs comes up on the show, as Pete and I have pointed out, it's usually, you know, when should Australia Day be? Or
that's a great
how
point.
Long should a Welcome to Country ceremony B. By the way, Comedy Festival, they are like a minute and a half at the moment. But anyway, not the point. The point is, it's great they're actually talking about something that has a huge impact on people's lives.
Of substance.
Yes, huge impact on society. The problem is, the Australian Law Reform Commission's report has recommended that Indigenous status should be considered as a factor in sentencing on the premise that special notice should be taken of socioeconomic disparities between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Now, equality before the law, one of the most precious principles of law that we have, and don't like how we're just immediately abandoning it.
Yeah, clearly you, bringing in people's race into sentencing is a horrendously bad idea.
Yes. History would show.
History would suggest.
You don't want to tinker with that one. So a few things you guys can do if you guys...
we do speak about that a bit more with Morgan later in the show.
Yes. So later in the show, we're going to be speaking about that with Morgan Begg, who is one of our senior people here in regards to the Legal Rights Project. Also, Andrew Bushnell heads up our Criminal Justice Project. Was all over this. He had an article today, which you can read on our website, just talking about how we cannot do away with equality before the law. And yeah, basically that.
Have a read.
Have a read of that. That is all we got time. That's all the stories we want to talk about at the start. So we'll now go to our interviews with Toombs and Morgan. Before we do, I just want to say thank you guys so much for listening to the show. So thank you so much for subscribing. Hopefully, we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email.
One click.
So just jump on whatever, which one you prefer. But if you are listening on iTunes, make sure that you are giving us a 5-star review. Let us know what you think of the show. Let us know if you have any tips. Maybe you have your own Q&A clap moment. Nina, how can people, if people really like what the IPA does, if people really like what we're talking about, how can they become members of the IPA?
Well, just visit the IPA website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join button. And as starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become a member for a year. And then you'll be receiving 4 free editions of our magazine's IPA reviews and also invitations to exclusive events.
Stick around later for a brand new segment we've got called Nina Cut Sick.
Yes, bated breath. Cool. All right, let's go to those interviews.
So what is Western civilization? How would you define it? It's, you know, it's not geographical. It's not in the West.
No.
It's not confined to the West, but obviously...
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say it has to be the sum total of our aspirations, values, conventions, traditions, institutions, the sort that create us as societies and enable us to live together fairly harmoniously, provide us with a kind of common language of social existence. So as you said, it's no longer geographical. Parts of it have become accepted pretty well universally, at least as aspirations. But nevertheless, it still has historical links with, I suppose, with the Christian world, with Christendom, with originally with Europe, and indeed with pre-Christian Europe.
Ancient Greece, for example.
Ancient Greece, yes. Ancient Greece, the idea of democracy, ancient Greece for many of our ethical ideas, ancient Rome for a large part of our legal system. And, of course, parts of medieval Europe, Christian medieval Europe, for many of our political institutions, or at least the origins of them. So I think that's part of it. But then you might say, well, but then what about the 18th century, the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason? That too. I mean, I think Western civilization is a whole lot of, it's an amalgam of a lot of different things. which is what probably makes it able to survive and adapt. It's not a civilization that regards its origins in a single source, a single religion, a single prophet, a single body of texts, but a very diverse and, I think one could say, inclusive selection of influences from quite a number of different periods of history and of different nations and cultures.
Yes, one of the criticisms I mentioned to you yesterday was a certain academic here criticised Western civilization not only for being past its use-by date, but for not being diverse enough. And as you say, it is the most diverse of all civilizations. It's absorbed and adopted and taken from other civilizations and perfected.
Yes. And of course, it's constantly changing. So I find it very difficult to see it as being past its sell-by date, because it's not a fixed body of ideas. It's a constantly changing set of principles and practices. It's not the same now as it was 100 years ago, or 300 years ago, or perhaps even 50 years ago. And so it's very difficult to, in fact, I don't think one can define it as a certain fixed set of ideas or laws. But nevertheless, there may be certain things that most of us would feel that we would like to include in our idea of Western civilization. And these would be things like, well, you mentioned democracy, the rule of law, tolerance, equality before the law, things of that kind. And also, of course, a whole set of cultural practices. Western civilization is not only about political structures, but it's also a very varied tradition of artistic culture, literary culture, musical culture, which many of us, in a sense, can possess going back over many hundreds of years. The fact that we admire paintings from the Italian Renaissance, that we can admire prehistoric cave paintings, that we can enjoy the music of Bach or indeed of modern, of 20th century of jazz. Or, you know, yeah. It's hard to think of a more of any of the world's civilizations that has a greater diversity of influence, and one that is constantly modifying itself. And that, I think, is the source of its strength.
What are the dangers of looking at just the dark pages of history when we're looking at something like at Western civilization?
Well, I think we risk undermining our own values by focusing only on the negatives. All histories, of course, contain tragedies and crimes, as well as episodes of, well, heroic and positive episodes. And if you, it's as much a distortion to focus only on the negatives as it will be to focus only on the positives. I think we have to accept that our history contains both. But to focus only on the negatives, it seems to me, risks undermining any sense that there are things of value that need to be protected and asserted. And those are things that belong to a certain tradition of politics. So, for example, things that we share: parliamentary government, the rule of law, the right to a fair trial, equality before the law. All these things we would almost certainly feel ought to be preserved. But if you regard them as part of a civilization which is worthless, then what is the justification for maintaining them? I think one has to accept that they are part of a whole civilization. If you regard the concept of Western civilization as being synonymous with a whole structure of power, then if you feel that you want to be in opposition to that structure of power, then you might say you're in opposition to the civilization that is part of it. I mean, I expect it certainly has its roots in, I would have thought, in 19th century political ideologies. Marxism is the most obvious, but also in anti-colonialist movements. If imperial structures are seen as somehow part of or structuring Western civilization. Western civilization as being imposed on other civilizations by force. And of course that is part of the story, but not the whole part of the story. I remember when I was writing this book, I did find it very difficult to write about imperialism and the memory of imperialism. And I wrote a draft and showed it to a colleague who's an Africanist. And he said, "Why are you so negative?" And I said, "I didn't know I was." He said, "Well, you have to realize that in many countries, British parliamentary practice, even if they don't themselves have it, or indeed especially if they don't themselves have it, is regarded as an aspiration to which they want to keep." So I think that, you know, if we start saying everything from the West is bad, then that includes concepts of human rights, it includes democratic practices and institutions. And I think it's quite dangerous to, in a sense, to provide an argument for governments and rulers in certain countries who claim a kind of legitimacy by saying that they're anti-Western. As it were to say, you people say that we should be tolerant, that we should be democratic, but that those are your values, they're not our values. We have a quite different civilizational tradition, which doesn't regard the equality of women as important, which doesn't regard individuals as having legal rights, which has a quite different set of principles, and therefore we just simply don't accept yours. And if we go along with that, then in some ways we're failing in a kind of duty, the duty of the powerful towards the weak, towards the peoples of those countries who are often suffering under tyrannical regimes, for whom certain excuses are sometimes made on the grounds that they have a separate and legitimate civilization.
Okay, we are now joined once again by a great friend of the podcast. Haven't had him on for a little bit, but, you know, welcome back. IPA Research Fellow Morgan Begg. Morgan.
Thank you, James.
He's been grumbling about not being on for a while.
Yeah, a lot of little clues left around the desks.
Yeah.
But awesome to have
horses' heads and stuff like that.
Yeah, that was a pretty big clue.
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry, Morgan. Big week for you, mate. We have finally released the long-awaited report into religious liberty in Australia. And we're also going to be talking to you about an article you had on farms in Queensland and maybe a few other things as well. But obviously, let's talk about this religious liberty report.
Sure.
Sorry, Morgan, can you define what religious liberty is?
Well,
yeah. Concisely.
13 seconds.
Well, yeah, 25 words or less.
Geez, well, I really shouldn't have wrote a 25-page report. Yeah,
mate, completely read the
I've exceeded
wrong.
The brief, yeah. Religious liberty can be thought of as a bundle of separate individual liberties. So the way I've described it, which someone else described it, and I've just stolen it, it's a delicate ecosystem of liberties.
It's called research. Include,
it's called, yeah. Yeah. Well, there was a citation, so look. this delicate ecosystem includes things like freedom of speech, freedom of association, the freedom to enter into contracts at your discretion, the freedom of conscience, and where one of those freedoms is threatened, or the entire sort of edifice underlying religious liberty is also threatened.
So what are the problems facing religious liberty in Australia, Morgan?
So the key threat, there's a number of threats which restrict how a religious person might express their faith. But the key threat in Australia is anti-discrimination laws, and particularly anti-discrimination laws at the state level, which might have restrictions on so-called anti-vilification speech, or restrictions on, you know, employment decisions, or restrictions on who you can serve at your place of business. So that's the key threat. And the sort of other side of that is we have this mistaken idea that well, religion's still protected because we have these exemptions in those laws, but the exemptions are deeply flawed and insufficient at best to protect individual religious freedoms.
And is this situation getting better or worse?
It's getting, on balance, it's getting worse. Most of the centre-left political parties at the state and federal level, the Greens and Labor essentially, are moving towards the removal of those exemptions. So what little protection there is under these laws are constantly under threat. The defensive on the other side isn't that powerful. And because they're fighting on the back foot, so on balance, it's not looking great, which is why we can't rely on these exemptions because they are under threat. So we need to attack the problem at the source, which is the anti-discrimination laws.
One thing, one law that the report mentioned in particular was 18C. So, you know, no good IPA report is released unless it somehow mentions 18C.
Climate change.
So obviously, if our listeners don't know, 18C obviously being a section of the Racial Discrimination Act, which prevents people from offending, humiliating, insulting or intimidating people on the basis of race or ethnic origin. Mm-hmm. So in regards to religious liberty, how does 18C limit that?
So 18C is... clearly a major law in Australia that undermines free speech, which is that, you know, at the heart of that delicate ecosystem of what is religious liberty. 18C itself, on a clear reading, doesn't seem to be directed at, you know, religious speech, but it could conceivably catch, you know, a Christian speaker speaking about, you know, another religious group. Perhaps in Victoria, under similar but different laws at the state level, you had the same sort of thing play out, which ended up being a years-long legal process, which played out in the courts. So there is that threat, and the other aspect is that, you know, unlike a lot of the anti-discrimination laws, there's no exemption which attaches to religious speech under 18D.
Cool. So when the report got covered by The Australian, which on Wednesday got some really great coverage, I think it was like one of the first few pages in The Australian.
Very prominent.
One thing I noticed about the article was that Simon Breeny gave quotes and the image was Simon Breeny. Now, I thought the report came from you.
So. Yeah, I'll take this one, Slugger.
So my question is, what's it like being interview cucked by Simon Breeny?
Such a media tart.
It's just out of my way, Morgs.
No, he smashed it. No, well, what happened, and I was... it's a bit annoying that the report wasn't mentioned, but the news coverage was actually about when Simon and I spoke to the expert panel, which was reporting on religious freedoms in Australia. So I believe the quotes that were included in the article were from Simon's opening statement. So it was actually his work, and there was no theft or foul play.
Morgan clearly needs this job. But it was, James, a Morgan double shot, wasn't it, in the Oz?
It was indeed. So also on that day, actually, I just wanted to, so what was the panel you were speaking in front of?
The expert panel on religious freedoms in Australia, which was convened late last year by the Prime Minister, and in the next couple of months is going to produce a report based on thousands and thousands of submissions, including the report that the IPA submitted, on the state of religious protections under the Australian law.
And how are we feeling about the panel? Like, are they going to come back saying there's not enough protections? Are we going to say there's too many protections?
Good question. I'm not... they won't... The prediction I would make is that they probably won't make our recommendation.
No anti-discrimination laws.
Yeah. Unfortunately. But where they fall on that sort of spectrum between... no religious protections whatsoever, and our position, I'm not too sure.
Fair enough. All right, so as Pete did allude to, there was a double shot of Morgan Begg in the Wednesday Australian.
Make it a double.
Yeah. So You also had an op-ed about farms in Queensland, and particularly after the Palaszczuk government's proposed regulations on native vegetation in Queensland. So what were those? What were Palaszczuk's proposals?
Yep.
And what's wrong with them?
So the Queensland government's proposals were an attempt to overturn laws that were introduced by the previous government in 2013, which slightly relaxed the ability for farmers to clear their own land of, you know, native shrubbery and trees. Still, under the current laws as they are, the farmers need to, you know, seek approval from the department to clear land from, to clear their own property. But what the government's trying to do is to essentially reverse that and just completely make it impossible. So this is a terrible red tape burden. It's an attack on these property owners, in the one sense, on the value of their properties, and also on their property rights as landowners, and to restrict the way that they manage their own land.
Absolutely.
Now, you know about this stuff, Morgan, because you're a country boy yourself, aren't you?
That's right, yeah.
Eagle Hawk's favourite son.
That's, well,
man of the
people. I think that's objectively true. But,
the statue would speak to that. Yeah, so it's a weird one in that the Queensland government is able to just go, yeah, we know your farm better than you do. Like, here's what,
well, that's
you should
it,
do with that.
This isn't just a Queensland problem. It's a problem across Australia where government departments just presume to know the inner workings of how farms can and should be managed. But
the potato thing in Western Australia being a prime example.
Well, that's right, yeah. So it's this complete lack of faith in individuals to understand, well, you know, how can I manage my resources in a sufficient and decent way. You know, a farmer isn't interested in, like, raising his property and just salting the earth. You know, there's a commercial interest and an aesthetic interest,
yeah,
in conserving the sort of environmental situation in a decent way, but also balancing the commercial interest in owning the property in the first place.
And most farmers want to hand on their farm to their kids as well.
Well, so that,
they
well,
want it to,
yeah,
last
exactly.
Hundreds of years.
This isn't just a short-term issue for this. It's generations and generations that the farmers are interested in.
Absolutely. So, Morgan, you're putting yourself forward as someone who's just like, look, leave it to the farmers.
Mm.
I think that's a pretty good summation. I just want to bring to your attention a bit of social media feedback your article had.
Oh.
Mostly positive. I think
always
a
good
lot
spot
of,
for feedback.
Always a good
media.
Spot, yeah. Yes. Mostly positive. I think, especially on the Australian website, it was a lot of farmers just getting around Eagle Hawk's favourite son, Morgan Begg,
yeah,
as they constantly refer to you as.
Queensland loves Eagle Hawk.
Yeah. So, one I did see, and this is on our Facebook page, so people from the IPA know about farming more than people that spend their working careers researching this, ? Cool, I look forward to your piece on hydroponics.
Is that a drug reference?
I don't quite know.
What? And who are these people spending their careers researching it?
He specifically mentioned civil and environmental engineers, molecular biologists and horticulturists.
Oh, yeah.
So probably
working for the agricultural department of
Queensland. Yeah. But I do like that Morgan saying leave it to farmers is in itself not leaving it to farmers.
Well,
stay out of it.
Sorry, Morgan. Do you want to stay out of it?
Well,
what's your take on hydroponics?
That's the next major IPA report. But
well, I'll double check that. Figure out what hydroponics are.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, pad for me.
So James is currently Googling.
Yep.
Are we going to move on to incarceration?
I think so. It's a subset of hydroculture, the method of growing plants without soil. Any takes? Any hot takes on that? Could be good.
Well, yeah.
All right.
to today's big news. This has sort of been developing over the week, but I say today's news because the article that Andrew Bushnell wrote that Pete and I have already discussed in the show, the ALRC, I think it was... Can't quite remember. Yeah, Australian Law Reform Commission's report on Indigenous incarceration recently came out, Pathways to Justice, and it's sort of recommending that someone's Aboriginality should be taken into account when sentencing is being considered. Now, Morgan, you are a very senior member of our legal rights team here at the IPA. So what do you say to someone, what do you say to this report that seems to just do away with the notion of equality before the law?
Well, that's right. I mean, we're seeing centuries old fundamental legal principles derived from our British heritage just overturned before our eyes under the guise of this sort of cultural Marxist nonsense. This is some of the more odious proposals you'd hope to see from a government agency committed to law reform. Very, very disappointing. And what Andrew said on the subject is spot on. And for the listeners at home, yeah, make sure you read that.
Absolutely.
Sentencing people according to their race always ends well. Morgan, to what extent does this actually already occur, though, in the legal system?
It would happen. It's, judges have discretion over certain aspects of the sentencing process, and they can take into account personal circumstances of the person being sentenced. The discretion is probably better than having a formal rule, which sort of directs judges to do this.
Yeah, no matter what your position is,
or
you have
or
to.
Maybe the person in question, maybe that's not as much of a factor behind the crime as it would be for someone else. Mm. So does a blanket rule really belong? Well, no.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So, Morgan, last thing I want to discuss with you. So something that we put in Hay yesterday, obviously three of us, the Hay Musketeers, which is good.
Yeah.
Came up with it on the spot and immediately hated it. It might still be dumped from the show. But anyway, we highlighted that Kevin Williamson, reporter at large for the National Review, had recently jumped over to the Atlantic. He lasted all of 2 weeks there before the Atlantic have fired him because people have located... I mean, Pete and I will discuss this more in depth later in the show, but people have located some old tweets that he deleted and called for his sacking, and he has been sacked, and it does seem to be a bit of a, the confected outrage bringing down another person. What is your take?
Yeah.
Especially after, as you point...
episode. It happened the day after it was in Hay, so I can't help but feel that...
Another one falls on their sword.
We've done this before, and we've done it now, and we'll do it again.
I like to call us the Kingmakers.
Well, surely not. We're the King Slayers.
There's one...
We'll get you fired from any job you get.
We did one that went the other way. Anyway,
I can't remember. Well, we killed Boris Johnson's.
Yes,
leadership
this is
chances.
The famous one. Yes. Yeah. So this is as internal a joke as you can get. But Boris Morgan Begg put a huge plug for Boris Johnson as next Conservative leader, and I think next Prime Minister when there was. Put it in Hay, this will be it, he's going to win.
Yeah.
The next day, Boris Johnson withdrew from the race.
He never says that one. He always talks about how he said Trump was going to win. Yeah. He never said he dogged Boris.
Boris just gets an email notification, he's like, if Morgan's on my side, I've got no hope.
Kiss of death.
Cool. Morgan, thank you so much for joining us on the show. We'll have you back on again quite soon. Sooner than last time.
Oh, thanks for having me, boys.
See ya.
Okay, thank you to Professor Robert Toombs. We should also thank Dr. Bella DeBrera for the questions and also to Morgan Begg for those chats. Really interesting stuff. All right, let's fly through some stories that have made us laugh this week. Pete, if I may start.
Yeah, go, mate.
Cool. So I am a huge Wes Anderson fan. He's one of my favourite directors, and his new movie... What movies has he done, Pete? So my favourite is Royal Tenenbaums. Hopefully you guys have seen that. It's a really cool one. He's also done the Darjeeling Limited I like.
Not heard of it.
Grand Budapest Hotel got nominated for Best Picture.
Not heard of it.
Really? That one?
Mm. I haven't heard of any of those movies.
Yeah. Well,
did he do The Mighty Ducks?
He did not do The Mighty Ducks, nor did he do Cool Runnings.
Okay.
I had a... 3 nights ago, actually, I've got a giant A2 poster framed of Royal Tenenbaums, one of my favorite movies, crashed right behind my bed and scared the crap out of me.
Really?
It was like broken glass in my bed.
It's a sign.
Yeah, 4:30 in the morning. Hell of a way to wake up. Anyway, not the point. So Wes Anderson's new movie is Isle of Dogs, set in Japan. It's sort of like this futuristic society where Japan has just got rid of all dogs. They've put them on this like island, and a kid goes into the island to find his lost dog. And obviously the dogs and humans can't speak to each other.
Hmm.
So the dogs try to help this kid find his dog. And, you know, it's a classic Wes Anderson. You're not there for the plot. You're
classic.
There for the... Get it. We are watching Royal Tenenbaums this week, and I'm breaking into your house and putting it on.
Classic Anderson.
But anyway, you're not watching for the plot. You're watching it because it looks great and it's fun. But obviously some people have taken umbrage with the fact that it is set in Japan and that Wes Anderson is the whitest person to have ever lived.
Yeah.
So Justin Chang is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Chang's problem with the movie is that the language barrier marginalizes residents of Megasaki, which is the Japanese town in which it takes place, and renders them foreigners in their own city. Not only does it cut them out of Anderson's, quote, droll way with the English language, but it also makes them passive actors easily exploited by white Xavier Walker, who's another character, who becomes the angry heroic voice of Megasaki's pro-dog resistance.
What's that bloke's name?
Justin Chang.
He's a racist.
Yeah.
What would Prager say? He's a racist. What, a white person can't make movies with Japanese people?
Yeah, exactly.
Or Japanese people can't be in movies that a white person's made?
Yeah.
Racist.
Yeah.
Next.
Okay, well, you're next.
Okay, no. You got more. Okay,
no, you took everything I was going to say. Like, that's the modern left and white supremacists are the only people that think that white people can't make movies about other cultures. But also, I just a quick tip for any developing journalists out there. If you ever write the sentence, becomes the angry heroic voice of Megasaki's pro-dog resistance, you're reading too much into something.
You probably are.
Just sit back and enjoy the stop motion, and also, like, Wes Anderson's really cool, and Pete should watch it.
Get a choc top.
Yep.
All right, so another thing that that we noticed this week was a council in England has said, in Brighton and Hove Council in England has said, and this is part of a program called Poverty Proofing Your School, that teachers shouldn't allow students to talk about what they did on the weekend because it might stigmatise poorer students who didn't have as good a weekend, presumably.
Yep.
Now, I never did anything in my weekend when I was a kid, but that wasn't because we were poor. It was just because mum and dad were like, we don't really want to take you anywhere.
Yeah.
When you're older, you can go wherever you want, mate.
Yeah.
I
wasn't allowed video games, so I couldn't really discuss all the good levels that we beat.
And Melbourne lost every week, so that was always a bit of a trauma. There was
how times have changed.
Hey, mate, one on one. This is a bit of a segue, but once after Melbourne lost to Sydney when they hadn't won a game for like 37 games in a row, I asked Dad if I could skip school, and he was like, no. Anyway, go to school. And as I said yesterday in Hey, What Did I Miss? Poverty proofing your school. The best way to poverty proof someone is to give them a good education.
Yeah.
Maybe focus on that.
Mm. You should have adjusted some glasses there.
Yeah. Sort of sat back.
Yeah. Just tap the chair a few times. I don't quite get how banning kids talking about their weekends poverty proofs a school.
Yeah, well...
Or is it just put it out of sight for a little bit? It's like, you know, putting like dust under the carpet.
But this is... Yeah, it's like, don't actually do anything about the fact that children are poor. Just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, just, you know, look the other way.
How can that be the...
I have no idea.
So those people sitting in that organisation that are like, oh, don't worry about that, they're poor, let's just hide it. Sorry, I had a bit of a stroke then.
That's okay. I think we've discussed it all. We'll move on. So another thing that's come out of the Britain this week. So the BBC is to insist that half of its expert voices heard on news and current affairs programs are women by next year. So obviously last week, if you guys were listening, we talked to IPA campus coordinator Renee Gorman,
mm-hmm.
who wrote an article and got up in the face of the University of Sydney Student Union for making sure for their proposal to get half of their debate teams to be women and to have like gender quotas and other sort of quotas. So if you guys want to, and if you guys want to like get deep dive into the issue of gender quotas, listen to Renee's interview with us from last week. But so don't love the BBC doing this. It's just a bit like, oh, you're only here because you're a woman and we needed someone to figure it out. So,
sexist.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how does it...
Well, it goes the other way as well. Like, if you want a job, just jump on a bloody BBC jazz ballet panel.
Yeah.
Because they have to give me a job because there's probably male jazz ballet. I shouldn't say that, but you see my point.
Yes.
I should probably apply to BBC then.
Yeah.
Because I'm guaranteed to have a job then.
Yeah, just something that women are completely uninterested in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because really offended. Yeah,
panel about Bolt. Nah, I could not say that. We've come out.
Yeah, it's very cool. As in something that women aren't interested in, your first port of call was jazz ballet.
No, that's something men aren't interested in.
Oh, men aren't.
So, because I could apply.
Oh, right. No, I don't think there'd be a male quota, Pete. I don't know if that's the temperature people are taking.
No, that's a 50-50 gender quota, isn't it?
Oh, okay. We make more of the system.
This is what I mean. Like, that means they have to hire men to do stupid shit that men shouldn't be doing. You can just say, mate, that's Diary's war.
Oh, that's true. Apologies to any families out there. This piece just cracked loose. Cool. So speaking of someone getting cracked loose, someone has cracked loose of the Atlantic, Pete.
Yes. Well, Kevin Williamson, who was previously a roving reporter with National Review and a very famous conservative / libertarian. Conservative says libertarian, actually. A few of the boys upstairs say he was actually libertarian. He got hired by The Atlantic, which is a kind of a left-wing magazine that sort of wants to portray itself as actually have a diversity opinion, be a bit mainstream, a bit like the New York Times, hire one or two sort of token conservatives. So
but I liked The Atlantic. They usually have some good stuff. Yeah, like, I mean, it's a left of centre stuff, but they've got some really cool long reads. It's better than the New York Times.
Absolutely, and there's nothing wrong with the left-wing magazine, per se. The thing was, we said yesterday, and how did I miss that, this hire has created the typical hysteria amongst the left, and like, you know, look at all his opinions he has that are conservative.
Yeah.
And then, this morning...
Just to put it... His first article for The Atlantic is Why the Libertarian Moment is Dead, which a few of the boys and our research team are just like Kevin Williamson, you know, hat in hand coming, like, please like me. I'm on your side now. Yep. Don't make me end up like Brett Stevens.
I think Bushnell said he sold out his old mates for clicks.
Yeah. I said that, Pete.
Did you say that? Yeah. I thought you got it off Bushnell.
Well, maybe I did, but I thought I came up with that originally.
Yeah, maybe Bot came up with that. Anyway, the point is that, lo and behold, we come into it this morning and he has been sacked. Mm-hmm. So there's a few things to take out of that. Firstly, it's like, did you guys not Google this bloke? Like, what do you think he's been doing for the last 20 years? And secondly, it's like the scope of what you can actually say is getting smaller.
Yeah, so he got sacked because people found tweets that he sent out 6 years ago now or 4 years ago, but many years ago.
4 to 6.
Yeah, 4 to 6 years ago, that sort of ballpark area, about abortion, obviously pretty touchy subjects, and they weren't exactly the best tweets in the world. I don't think we're mincing words by saying that, but they were deleted and they've just, you know, found it, used it as an excuse to get this guy out of there because they didn't want a conservative of The Atlantic, and he's gone. My point with that is this is how you get Trump. Like,
yeah, exactly.
If Kevin Williamson can't work at The Atlantic, you guys can't be surprised when people vote Trump.
Yeah, well, Ben Shapiro's tweet, what are those things called when you do 10 tweets?
Tweet threads.
Tweet threads.
Yeah. I make fun of tweet threads, like, this is a really important thread, but this is actually a really important thread.
Often it's like, you know, I just got kicked off the bus for not having a ticket. And
One of 217 tweets. You're like, oh boy.
But Ben Shapiro's is excellent and really describes it well. So jump on Twitter and have a look if you're interested. But he basically says that, you know, if you just make this window of what's actually acceptable opinion smaller and smaller, and everyone outside that window is a deplorable, as the left calls them, then what's the point again?
Yeah.
that's the point.
No, then you get the how you get Trump.
Yeah, so the alt. So if everyone who outside of that is, so all conservatives and all libertarians and the alt-right are all the same, then you're actually legitimizing the alt-right.
Yeah, exactly.
And the, you know, the really dodgy end of the alt-right.
Yeah. My other point is, like, so Kevin Williamson, because of these tweets that he sent out a few years ago, and he gets fired, it's sort of saying that every view he has is illegitimate. It's like, if you believe this one thing about this one topic, then every other opinion you have on any topic under the sun
is
illegitimized by this one thing that you think.
Yep.
Which is, in turn, good news for libertarians, because the libertarian moment might not be dead, because if we have to invalidate all this stuff he says because of this, it's a summer of libertarianism. So...
I get it. Yeah. That's right. No, but that's a good point. So then it's like stuff like, well, you know, we should lower taxes. You're suddenly in the same boat as.
Yeah, well, you can't say.
Whatever.
Yeah, we can't listen to you because you also said that thing 10 years ago. Yeah. So, yeah, get out of here.
Cool. Shapiro. Shapiro does it really well.
Yes. Pete and I don't.
we were serviceable.
I think we got the answer. We did our best. I think we elicited two nods.
Yeah, I think I know what these guys are getting at.
A two nod minimum.
I'll check the internet.
I'll check the professional. All right, last segment, the one we've all been waiting
for. This is why people have hung around.
All right,
unfortunately, people would have listened to that.
You gutted it out through Pete and I getting around the Kevin Williams issue.
I don't understand why this is a segment anyway.
All right, well, Nina, you found a story this week that made Nina...
bloody lose it.
Yeah, yeah. Really furrow those eyebrows.
She's an absolute, you know, dragon when she wants to be. Like, she was breathing fire.
Mm.
Anyway, hit us, Nina.
I wasn't. Oh, anyway, I come across with this article from the New York Times. Someone sent it to my emails. And it's the title said Utah passes free-range parenting law. And according to this article, who's that? Who introduced the Utah bill? State Senator Lincoln Fillmore, who introduced the Utah bill in January, said the bill specifies what constitutes child neglect in the state and what does not. Under the law, neglect does not include, quote, permitting a child whose basic needs are met and who is in sufficient age and maturity to avoid harm and unreasonable risk of harm to engage in independent activity, such as going to and from school by walking, running, or bicycling, going to nearby stores or recreational facilities and playing outside.
So you're... Sorry, that,
no, go on. You got to say something?
So this bill is outlawing that?
That's no, that bill saying actually... If you let your child goes up play outside, it doesn't mean it's you neglect your children.
So they needed to.
So then it actually makes a law stating that you're not neglecting your children by sending them playing the playground or going to school, walking, cycling by yourself.
Because that happens in the States all the time. Parents get reported to the police because they let their kid walk home from the park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like. My childhood, I don't know about yours, but my childhood, I played outside all the time.
Yeah. No, it was very much happened. Like, I don't know how you guys were brought up there.
Yeah, I know. You like, guys are... How do you, I mean, this is horrible.
Yeah, it's rubbish. Yeah.
So that's, yeah.
Nina Katsik.
All right, I think we're bringing this segment back, but I just also would like to say, Pete, do you want to take a few notes as to how to introduce the topic?
What's facts, with all those facts and information?
The quoting, context.
She prepared
general.
It.
Yeah,
that's why. That's in. Why it should be a segment. Yeah. Like, the reason why this has come out because I introduced this to you guys, right?
Yeah.
And I was expecting you guys to introduce this to people.
But obviously you're much better
that's
at it than
right.
I am.
Nina said you guys should talk about this. And we said, you know what, Nina, you should talk
about
this.
And I was like, what? I shouldn't.
And she did a better job than Pete. So next week, I hope you guys tune into the Young IPA podcast with James and Nina with Pete pressing the button.
Why is it you and Nina?
What?
It's probably just Nina.
It's the Nina half hour.
Yeah.
Cool. So thank you guys so much for listening. That's it for the show this week. Thank you to Dr. Bella DeBrera. Thank you to Professor Robert Toombs and to Morgan Begg. Forgot who we did interview. So hopefully you guys enjoyed the show. If you did, make sure you subscribed on all of the platforms that we're available on, such as iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. And if you do like the show on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. Let us know what you think about the show. Maybe a few tips, maybe your own Q&A clap moment, or if you've got a story lead.
Just something for Nina.
Anything, yeah. Maybe something Nina can get riled up on. She's big on free-range children. Pete, how... Oh, sorry, not Pete. You're done.
I've actually been demoted.
Yeah.
So what Pete, you can do is, you can, if you want to sign up as a member to the IPA, www.ipa.org.au, sign up a young member for $22. What else do you say? I don't know.
You're actually
there. Good job, Pete. That's
we should just swap.
That's actually pretty much.
Yeah, basically. All right, cool. See you guys next week.
See ya.